The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, our final panel brings us in a beautiful circle back to our first panel this morning, because what we see in our final panel are the general abstract theoretical themes that were sounded, brought into very specific form in a very particular context by our three wonderful panelists. Because we are short in time for this panel, I will abbreviate their introductions and do them all at once. Susan Scafidi is, she's visiting at Georgetown now, but she normally teaches at SMU, where she has an appointment both in history and law. So she brings to her work in intellectual property a very sophisticated and nuanced understanding of historical developments to the particular concepts that we'll be looking at today in the area of fashion. Vicki Phillips teaches here at American University at the Washington College of Law. As you know, she worked with me in starting the Intellectual Property Clinic, and she has a long history of working in media law. And she brings together themes from media law and from intellectual property law in all of her work. And then we have Bhatma Bhatim, who is from the University of California at San Diego, where she has a PhD in communication. So you see the interdisciplinary focus of this panel, as well as the overlap with a concern about communication and how communication thought and theory and policy and practice intersect with the particular historical rules and practices of intellectual property law. We'll begin with Susan.
Thank you so much, Anna. I just want to thank you all for the invitation to come, and not just for that, but for creating the symposium in the first place, bringing this group together and making the world, the academic world anyway, a little safer for topics like mine, for intellectual property and fashion design, which is my post-tenure topic that I could finally safely get to. So today's remarks are part of a larger paper that some of you have heard bits of, and indeed a larger approach to studying intellectual property. The idea is to focus on areas of human creativity that are largely outside the legal regime. I had worked on cultural groups in the past, in order to identify cultural factors that result in some areas receiving extremely high protection and other areas almost none at all. In the United States, anyway, fashion is, of course, one of those areas with very little protection outside of trademarks, especially when those trademarks are on the outside of the good as opposed to on the label, but in general, very little. And these differences across industries are very dramatic, and they can't be explained just by economics or incentive theories. We would still have music and poetry without intellectual property protection, just as we would still get dressed in the morning, but again, the levels of legal protection couldn't be farther apart. So what I've done before is identified a whole series of cultural factors. Some days it's seven, some days it's nine, but that contribute to the outsider status of fashion and may point to the outsider's reasons for the outsider status of other areas as well. But today I'm going to limit my remarks largely to gender. It's one of the most important factors, of course, and also one of those that is most explicitly referenced throughout the history of the industry's attempts to gain protection in the United States. So I have lots of smoking guns to share with you. I was so delighted to hear the panels this morning, though, because some of the other areas that overlap with gender and that are indeed my other categories are those dichotomies that you all were expressing this morning, mind and body, and of course from this afternoon, things like class and race. But today, gender. As I've been writing this article, I've been reading the trade papers, which is kind of basic prerequisites for studying the industry, and talking to members of the industry, and it's been apparent for some time that the fashion industry was going to try again to break into the realm of intellectual property protection. And a few weeks ago, the CFDA, the Council of Fashion Designers of America, contacted me to talk about what they were up to and has recently engaged in some lobbying efforts in this regard. So it's in very early stages. There hasn't been a whole lot of public notice. Basically, FYI, what they're asking for is the equivalent of boat hull protection, only shorter, just 3 years. But the one public article that has come out about this has a very revealing title. Slate did a piece called Copycat Fight. So, my first smoking gun. When it comes to IP and gender, it's repeated throughout the debate. So, to start with a quick history. We, of course, all wear clothing, but in Western culture, sartorial fashion is explicitly gendered, both in production and in consumption. So I've called it over and over a pink-collar industry. This goes back to the 17th century, really. Prior to that, men were often the peacocks of the human species. But after that time, the spreading influence of Protestantism and the rise of the Industrial Revolution and the very plain dark suit as the uniform of that Industrial Revolution led men to abandon those high heels and ruffles. But women's dress didn't modernize at the same rate. So over the course of the 18th century, a real chasm emerged between the presumably practical clothing worn by men and the very fantastical gowns and hairstyles worn by fashionable women. The commercial production also of fashionable female clothing passed into the hands of women. So when in the mid-19th century, Charles Frederick Worth, who is the man recognized anyway as the first haute couturier, initially established his house in Paris, he was described rather derisively as a man milliner. A little whiff of scandal around the idea of a man actually measuring women for clothes, and a little bit of disgust at the idea that a man would sully his hands with such profession. In France, however, that gendering didn't prevent the expansion of copyright protection to what became an extremely important export industry. Nevertheless, it helped in the development of a top-down model of the industry, in which Paris dictated and everybody else copied, either legitimately after paying a licensing fee or by various means of stealing designs. In the U.S., our contemporary perception of the gendered nature of fashion crystallized academically, at least, over a century ago, 1899, with Thurston Veblen publishing The Theory of the Leisure Class, the text that, of course, gave us the term conspicuous consumption. Veblen was a sociologist and an economist who was very critical of the status-seeking behavior of the upper classes, and he described the use of public display of wealth through unnecessary expenditures in categories such as houses, food, and especially clothing, as a means of establishing or enhancing position in society. Looking at women, Veblen concluded that within the family unit, the role of the female, particularly the female head of household, was to consume for or on behalf of the male head of household. And her apparel is contrived, quote unquote, with this object in view. An expensive and impractical costume for a woman thus served as visual evidence that the wearer was a lady of leisure, thereby securing the prestige of the family as a whole. So women, in one blow, were linked to fashion and excluded from any kind of economic productivity in the market. During that same period, female dress reformers, such as the infamous Amanda Bloomer, who only wore bloomers for a year, actually, until there was an accident with some wind in her skirts, and female designers such as Coco Chanel and Madeleine Vionnet saw their role as one of liberating women from corsets, from dragging skirts that were unhygienic and difficult to manage, and so forth. At that time, moving into the early 20th century, even the labor movement had a gendered aspect, focused on the unhealthy conditions of sweatshops in which girls and young women worked, and especially after the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, this focus on young women workers and their unhealthy conditions and the unhealthy nature of the clothes that were then distributed was a matter of much concern. So moving to the connection to intellectual property. The first preliminary discussions of IP protection for fashion in the U.S. were, again, associated in the early 20th century with international expositions, but the talk soon turned to protection of domestic creation, both of clothing and of textiles. In 1924, a congressman named Albert Vestal introduced the first version of a bill to enact design protection. He started by thinking about patent, and then he changed it to copyright. But what's interesting for our purposes is that the pun on his name, Vestal, underscored the idea that he was protecting a women's industry. He was, of course, referred to as the Vestal Virgin, keeping a sacred fire burning for the goddess of the public hearth. Throughout the late 20s and into the early 30s, there was debate on various versions of the Vestal bill, specifically focused on women's clothing, and opponents of protection had as their mascot the, quote, poor working girl, so we get class added to gender. So opponents of this kind of protection said things like, this bill is designed to take away from the poor working girl the right to wear the same pattern of goods that wealthy people do, or we're all interested in the poor working girl, what will she be able to wear? The proponents of the bill, interestingly, and this straight from the congressional record, tended to refer to male creators rather than either female creators, of whom there were many, and female consumers. So you get things like, quote, there's no more reason or equity in allowing competitors to steal a man's designs than in allowing him to steal the goods on which the design appears. If you're in favor of it, it's men doing the creating. The bill was eventually amended to exclude private dressmakers. You wouldn't want good mother at home sewing clothes unable to do so to copy the fashions of the day. But even that didn't do it, and by the time the bill passed out of committee, dress designs had been omitted from the list of protection entirely, although things like footwear, jewelry, and textiles did remain. The public joined in the debate over the Vestal bill and related legislation, including a 1932 bill, for example, designed specifically to protect handbags. And there were women's voices that were part of this congressional debate and the public debate on both sides. So submitted to the committee, there was a letter from Helena Weed of the American Association of University Women. She joined on the side, again, with the class differential of the poor woman, and she wrote, the rich woman can either have her clothes made to order or buy the seasonal novelties at high prices, which will surely result from such a control, and she will discard those novelties when the styles are set, and women who must wait until the styles are set are ready to buy. But if these two bills are passed, there will be no production of cheaper models in the season's prices until the end of the season. And she went on to say, we all have a right to the beauty as well as the utility of clothing. The counterargument came from none other than Mrs. Condé Nast. And she wrote, notice it wasn't her husband writing, it was she, on the other hand, wrote to the New York Evening Telegram. And she said, the women who pay several hundred dollars for original gowns have the right to expect that their gowns will not appear on the $10.75 racks in the stores next week. The bill failed. And subsequently, there were, over the next decade or two, private efforts by the Fashion Originators Guild and the Millinery Creators Guild, among others, to enforce some kind of agreement among retailers not to buy any kind of knockoffs. That ran into antitrust objections when it was challenged in court and fell to the wayside. But interestingly, the popular debate continued, and contrary to what one might expect, popular literature seemed to fall on the side of Mrs. Condé Nast rather than the American Association of University Women. During this period also, we get into the late 30s, 1940s, we get the development of a creative fashion industry in the U.S. among American designers in response to the sudden wartime lack of imports from France. So just to give you a couple examples of the kinds of things that that were said in the public domain in favor of some kind of protection, we get a 1938 volume by a woman named Elizabeth Hawes. She wrote a book called Fashion is Spinach that was a part of her autobiography. She'd been a young woman, a young American, who wanted to become a fashion designer, went to study in France. The only job she could get in France was as a copyist, posing as a young American client so she could go in and quickly sketch what was coming down the runways and could then be knocked off. After she was finally recognized and therefore fired, she came back to the U.S. and became a designer herself, with the idea that she would provide designs for the modern American woman, and this was part of her mission. When she wrote this book in 1938, it became an immediate runaway bestseller and was reprinted that year at least 8 times. She ultimately left design, interestingly, and became a labor union organizer as her next career. Shortly after that, in 1943, we get Superman on the scene. And had I brought my PowerPoint slides from you, we would have Superman here now. A 1943 story with Superman, we've got Lois Lane buying an expensive original, seeing it knocked off, uncovering a counterfeit ring, naturally putting herself in moral peril, and Superman comes in to save the day. Interestingly, though, in doing this, Jerry Siegel, one of the two creators of Superman who wrote this story himself, made it clear from the very first panel that the Man of Steel had no interest in fashion himself. In fact, in that first panel, Lois is practically dragging Clark Kent into the clothing store while he protests, "But Lois, I'll feel out of place in a fashionable women's clothing establishment. It's all about the women's clothes." Not that he wasn't dressed, mind you. A man who runs into a telephone booth and changes into tights, not interested in fashion, you tell me. Again, around the same time, a contemporary note writer in the 1940 Yale Law Journal attempted to find a middle ground regarding copying, but not because he was listening to the women involved on either side. He said very explicitly, and I'm so sorry this was never edited out, "The women's apparel industries are distinctive for the irrational buying habits of their consumers." What was irrational? The desire to have an original and not just to be happy with a cheap copy. As the debate continued in the 50s in the courts, there was some sympathy for an industry under siege from copyists, but there was no sympathy for commercial competitors, only for the poor women who were either sewing at home or wanting to buy things. So one judge said in 1956, "Let women, nature's exquisite handiwork and gift to mankind, have the unrestrained privilege of copying or imitate any fashion that has been made public. Withhold such consideration, however, from those commercial parasites who make it their life's work to deceive and defraud by copying for profit to themselves alone." Around the same time, the Little Women had a new attitude. Second wave feminism came along and had kind of internalized Veblen's critique and his association of the woman as a mere clothes horse and a signifier of family wealth with her lack of power in the marketplace or in the public sphere generally. So among many others, Simone de Beauvoir in the mid-50s, writing The Second Sex, had a lot to say on the subject. She said, "Since woman is an object, it's quite understandable that her intrinsic value is affected by her style of dress and adornment. It's not entirely futile for her to attach so much importance as she does to silk or nylon stockings, to gloves, to a hat, because it's an imperative obligation for her to keep up her position. In America, a large part of the working girl's budget is assigned to beauty care and clothes." So we're back to our little mascot again. She also has some comments on the duty of a married woman to go out and entertain, parading her new costume from one drawing room to another. And while, of course, her husband occasionally accompanies her, he's usually at work while she, quote, attends to her social duties. "The deadly ennui that affects these functions has been described 1,000 times. So against this background, and despite concern in the 1960s about fashion's decreasing ability to control through mechanical means or technological means the copying, or at least slow down the process, it's small wonder that the legislative history of the 1976 Copyright Act, when it starts to talk about separable design elements and what can and cannot be copied, specifically excludes, in a list of excluded things, quote, "ladies' dress." Not clothing in general, mind you, just ladies' dress. As recently as 1991, that language is repeated in a Copyright Office policy decision that notes that certain kinds of costumes may be subject to protection, but, quote, "ladies' dress and other clothing," okay, we've expanded it now, cannot. Textile patterns, on the other hand, over these same decades, which are produced more often by men and, more importantly, by large machinery, had been under much less of a handicap. So not only is a fashion clearly a gendered industry, not just anecdotally but specifically, but that largely unexamined factor directly informed debates over intellectual property protection. In this rhetoric, fashionable women, as we've seen, are variously working girls in need of special protection and who are expected to copy their betters. There's a sense that fashion only trickles down. Women are irrational. Women are domestic producers, perhaps, but not commercial producers. And women are reduced to objects signaling status, or in some cases, signaling sexual attractiveness. The discussion wouldn't be complete, of course, without mentioning the more recent association between gay men and fashion. Once again, like women, as both producers and consumers. Heterosexual men, at least in the U.S., maintain a status associated with their gender by eschewing cutting-edge clothing designs and disclaiming knowledge of fashion trends. So remember Superman not even wanting to go into the store. Men who acknowledge their homosexuality, by contrast, are already transgressing gender boundaries. And so maybe we might think about that being consistent with that behavior with being consistent with the gay male community collectively adopting the feminized realm of fashion as a signaling device, as a form of personal expression, even as an accepted profession. Gay male designer is almost a tautology, right? So from Oscar Wilde, whom we saw earlier, who's quite a dandy himself, to Queer Eye for the Straight Guy on television, the gay man with superior fashion sense has become another cultural stereotype next to the woman out shopping. But in the still predominantly male legislative and judicial realm, a creative industry that's strongly gendered female or non-normatively male is going to be something of a disadvantage in seeking legal protection. I think it's neither coincidental nor superfluous that both political and academic debates regarding the industry have very regularly referenced this association with women. And I do want to say that while this relative lack of protection doesn't automatically follow from a low cultural valuation, both in this case, the social history and the legislative history imply that that association between femininity and fashion has weighed against its inclusion among the core forms of protected creativity in intellectual property law. So ultimately, this history doesn't make protection of fashion design a moral imperative or a legal imperative or anything else, but it does. It is one of the factors that puts us on notice that IP is, as we've said often today, a culturally determined system, and that any future rationalization or indeed international harmonization of that system has to recognize and be able to answer that issue. Thanks.
I'm going to completely shift gears because I'm going to leave women's bodies. And move to, well, I'm not going to leave women's bodies totally. I'll show you why in a second. Being a clinician, I'm going to today tell you a story. I'm going to talk to you about quilts. I'm not a quilter. Actually, Boatma, my friend Boatma, is a quilter. I can't even sew, and I'll admit that today. But I get hooked on the story of these women of Guise Ben when we were planning our first IP gender symposium, and the exhibit of their quilts rolled into town to the Corcoran Museum here in Washington. And the connection to these women and this community and these quilts was really an instant one for me. And then I started to dive into the whole backstory of these women and their community. And the more I followed the story in the last couple of years since our first gathering, and the more it developed, the more I got really fascinated with them and fascinated with the story and fascinated with how it connects to our topic today. So let me begin with this story. This is a quilter from Guise Bend, Alabama. And these also are quilters from Guise Bend, Alabama, with, you might recognize her, former Sports Illustrated swimsuit cover supermodel, Kathy Ireland, who is a lifestyle empire, the Kathy Ireland Worldwide Home Products Empire. How did these women, what journey took them from this sleepy, isolated area in Alabama to hanging out with supermodel Kathy Ireland? And before I attempt to map this connection, I think, like Susan, I'll give you a little background, a little history on this community. Guise Bend is a remote peninsula on the bend in a river in rural southwest Alabama, the Alabama River, heading back to the south like Anne. Joseph Gee of North Carolina moved to Alabama, and he established this plantation in 1816. In 1824, he died, but left his 47 slaves and the plantation on the Bend to his nephews. In 1845, the nephews, owing a debt to their relative Mark Petway up in North Carolina, gave him the land and the slaves as settlement. And then Mark Petway and his family moved there with 100 slaves. After the Civil War, all the freed slaves who lived in the Bend took Petway's name, and they stayed and they worked the land as sharecroppers. In 1895, the Petway family sold the land, left Gease Bend. The land changed hands several times after that. There were a series of absentee landlords and overseers, but life for the freed slaves remained pretty much the same. The sharecropping system was dependent on this arrangement called advancing, where merchants would supply the tenant farmers with the seed and other necessities they needed at the beginning of the season, and then they paid exorbitant interest at the end of the season. But this arrangement obviously depended on stable cotton prices, and by 1931, the price of cotton had fallen from 40 to 5 cents a pound. Many in the country fell into debt, including the people of Gee's Bend. And the widow of a prominent regional merchant foreclosed on all the debtors on the Bend and sent her henchmen to the Bend to carry away all their belongings, taking farm animals, food, everything they had. Essentially, the area was declared a state of emergency. The Red Cross sent aid, and President Franklin Roosevelt declared the community the poorest community in the poorest county in the country. Then, with the Farm Security Administration, the government purchased all the former plantation land, and it granted low-interest loans to the Gee's Bend families to buy the land and build houses. Many families in the Bend took advantage of this program and bought the farms they had been working. The civil rights struggle even reached the Bend in 65, and Martin Luther King even visited there and preached. And reminiscent of Ann's talk, the Bend was renamed Boykin after a congressman with absolutely no ties to the area. Maybe he knew Strom Thurmond and the octogenarians in Congress. But obviously, like many people, they still call it Gee's Bend. So how do we get to quilts? These women of Gee's Bend started during this period to sell their quilts for about $5 a piece to the civil rights activists who passed through the area. It had been very rote before, but the civil rights struggles saw people coming through this region, and they were really interested in the quilts. But for six generations, the women had worked in near isolation in this strip of land, teaching their daughters to quilt using any piece of material they could find, scraps, feed sacks, old work clothes. They had little time, even less energy. They worked along the fields all day with the men, plowing, cutting, planting cotton. They kept the home. They cared for children. But they spent their nights together quilting, and these periods were welcome respites from the other chores. It was obviously also a vital means to keep them warm. They turned these rags into covers to keep their loved ones warm in the drafty and unheated homes. But also in a life of servitude, where self-expression was obviously discouraged, the women turned to both religion and singing in addition to quilting as really their only outlets for self-expression. The quilts, as most quilts, these are not quilts, these are for Boatema's presentation, but it's nice to have them. I feel comfortable with them. The quilts were filled, obviously like all the quilts, with personal meaning associated with life processes like marriage, childbirth, homemaking, the struggles that the women had encountered. And this was really about the only bit of control these women could retain in their otherwise uncontrollable life. And their technique and their style were left to develop with little outside influence, very unlike traditional American quilting patterns. Now, obviously, as you can even see from Boatema's textiles, they brought some of these traditions from West African textile and even to some extent American quilting traditions, but their inspiration came as well from crossword puzzles and other newsprint, comic strips tacked onto their homes to keep them warm for insulation. In the Bend, as in other quilting traditions, piecing the top of the quilt, the top is the side that faces up on the bed, was almost always pieced by a quilter working alone. It reflected her single artistic vision. But the rest of the process of quilting, as we're familiar, sewing together the top, the batting, and the back, was a communal effort that the women did together on these nights. And obviously, the quilt's value for these women was not only in the final quilt produced, but in the process of their collective creation, when they gathered together at the end of a long day, sharing their lives, their struggles, and their joys. In 66, one of the civil rights workers that came by was Episcopal priest Francis Xavier Walter. He had head the Selma Interfaith Religious Project, and he saw the quilts as he walked through the area. He purchased some quilts from the women for $10 a piece, twice the price that they had been selling to the civil rights workers that had come through, and he organized an auction to benefit the civil rights movement in New York. The quilts sold for an average of about $27. The next year, a second auction made over $2,000. Under Walter's direction, he set out to help the community set up the Freedom Quilting Bee. It was established as a collective, and the profits from the auctions were used to make more quilts, build an office for the collective in nearby Alberta, and to provide child care so the women could participate, so more of them could participate. He also sent a product manager to the Bend, and she worked with the women to improve the consistency of their quilts, teaching them sewing, and they were encouraged to follow patterns and designs much more like traditional quilters to capitalize on this folk trend that was taking over. In 66, New York City designer Sister Parrish negotiated a contract with the Quilting Bee, and they also received contracts for quilts and pillows from Bloomingdale's, Sears, and Lord & Taylor in the 60s and early 70s. In these agreements, they were asked to use materials and patterns provided by the retailers. Their craft was valued in the Bee, but not really their unique expression and style. But in their need for this self-expression, they continued to make these quilts in their evening gatherings, and they did the contractual stuff according to the specifications. And in 67, the road to Gee's Bend was paved for the first time. The income from the Bee had increased the region's income by 25%. There's an interesting story that there was a civil rights worker who left her job in Gee's Bend, moved up to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and tried to sell some of these quilts she'd collected down there at local Cambridge craft shops, but she could hardly sell any, and she soon abandoned the project because the purchasers were turned off by the old rags and the old clothes and the imperfectness of the stitching. And so the folk, as fashion trends go, as we heard from Susan, the folk trend died as well, and demand for the quilts dwindled, and cheap machine-made quilts took over the market, and the Quilting Bee's profits declined. But the Bee limps along. It limps along even today. It fills orders for conference tote bags and other hand-sewn items. And as interest in the Bee waned and the civil rights workers went home, the Bend fell back into rural isolation. So what happened? How did we get to Cathy Ireland when this happened? In 1998, a chance encounter changed the quilters' lives, but this time the change was going to be very significant. William Arnett, an art scholar and collector from Atlanta, came across photos of quilter Annie Mae Young and her quilts in a book about African-American quilters. He was so taken with the image, he set off to the Bend and purchased as many quilts as he could. He bought almost 700 of them and reportedly paid between $100 to $2,500 a piece. Now, the quilters were not strangers to outside interest in their craft, but Arnett's transactions were a little different with the women because he also contracted for the underlying intellectual property rights to all the quilts made before 1984. He transferred, and it's a little unclear what those are, but he structured some arrangement with them. The facts are very fuzzy on this because the only facts we have are what he has told my research assistant in an email exchange. But in 2002, with these quilts and in cooperation with the Houston Fine Arts Museum, he and his nonprofit alliance, to which he transferred the quilts so that he didn't have any appearance of impropriety, they presented an exhibition of 70 of these quilts. And it went from Houston, and it was here at the Corcoran Museum and the Whitney Museum of Art in New York, and went to 11 art museums throughout the country. The New York Times hailed the quilts as some of the most miraculous works of modern art America has ever produced. The quilts were compared to the works of Henri Matisse and Paul Klee. And based on this tremendous acclaim from these traveling quilts, the Tinwood Alliance soon created several spin-off corporations. These include Tinwood Media, which has Tinwood Books, which published two books on the quilt making and the quilt makers. Tinwood Music produced a compact disc compilation of the quilters, mainly singing spirituals. Tinwood Films produced a documentary, The Quilts of G's Bend, which was a companion to the museum exhibition. And almost most importantly, Tinwood Ventures was created as the primary marketing arm of the enterprise. It was run by Arnett's MBA son, Harrison. The subsidiary has set out on a very aggressive licensing program based on the IP of the quilts. The Arnetts figured early on that the G's Bend aesthetic was going to have an impact on a variety of areas, primarily fashion and home. And that's how we come to Kathy Ireland. This is why I told you I wasn't really leaving women's bodies, because of her swimsuit history. So in 2003, this has happened after I started following the story, the Tinwood Ventures announced this partnership with Kathy Ireland Worldwide to produce home products using the quilt designs. The huge lifestyle empire founded by this supermodel sells her vast array of home products under the trademark slogan, Finding Solutions for Families, Especially Busy Moms. She said of the partnership with the women of G's Bend, there's nothing I desire to do unless it's going to lift up these women and make their art visible. It can't be cheapened. It's got to be tasteful. I want the artist to recognize her art when she sees it. This is one of the licensed products. She's since entered into deals with Arrow Home Fashions to produce sheets, comforters, duvet covers, window treatments, accessory pillows. I don't really know. I guess accessory pillows. What are they? I don't know. But throws, quilts, down products, bed pillows, mattress pads, and even a G's Bend pet-proof rug. She's also sub-licensed the designs for other products in agreements with Area Rugs Online, Hannah Candles, Shaw Floors, Pacific Coast Lighting, the retailer Anthropologie, and many others to promote and produce these G's Bend themed products. Here is a quilt design on a rug in a very nice home. Here's one of my favorites. This is a soy candle. Kathy has a nice little hang tag there. But in addition to just these home products, ironically, the place from where these things came, very different homes, albeit up here, Tinwood has engaged more recently in numerous other licensing ventures. There is your G's Bend cap. And one of my recent favorites, the Visa debit gift card. I mean, if there's not an ultimate sign of commodification, I think the debit gift card might take the cake. But the acclaim and the G's Bend market mania continues. Indeed, a second museum exhibition, G's Bend, the Architecture of the Quilt, has been organized again by Tinwood and the Houston Museum of Fine Art, and it's currently in Houston and traveling to several cities around the country. And this summer, you can buy at a post office near you G's Bend stamps. Now, whether this is an honor or the ultimate sign of commodification, I've been sort of betwixt and between, because we have definitely honoring stamps, but we also have a lot of Disney stamps. So the fact that they're on stamps, I'm mixed on that. But at the same time, with the assistance of Tinwood, the quilters, existing quilters, almost 50 of them, have formed the G's Bend Collective. The Arnetts call this relationship a partnership with the community. Here is William Arnett with one of the quilters. The Arnetts note that the quilters own all the rights to the quilts made after 1984. In addition, they pay the community a royalty on all the license uses for the quilts made before 84, even though he allegedly, in some instrument, purchased the intellectual property rights to these quilts. The collective serves as the exclusive outlet for selling and marketing the quilts currently being produced by the women, and it is owned and operated by these women. He's also been working with the community to establish a G's Bend Foundation, and they hope to soon start construction on a community center there. In an email to my research assistant, Arnett writes, "We are sort of modeling our actions after the French law, which entitles the artist or artist family or trust to percentages of the sales price even after the artist has died." The droit de suite, enacted in France in 1920, is the inalienable right where French fine artists and their heirs have the right to be paid a royalty on the proceeds of any resale of their work. Arnett does acknowledge and did acknowledge to my research assistant that the quilters are not involved in any way in the negotiations with the commercial entities. He reasoned in the email exchange, traditionally artists, especially vernacular artists, have always been taken advantage of by commercial entities. We handle the negotiations with the companies we work with, always paying extreme attention to our fiduciary duty to the artists and their artwork. The community does know what projects we're working on, and we turn down far more than we accept. The Arnetts claim that to date, through the Tinwood Ventures licensing, more than $1 million has gone back to the Gee's Bend community. So the rich story of Gee's Bend and the quilts and the women of this community can be viewed from so many angles. The chapters are filled with the intersection of race, gender, anti-subordination, agency, and the many IP issues we've talked about today and in earlier panels, notions of authorship, creativity, originality, ownership, collective works, the invisible work, notions of the droit de suite and moral rights. But this afternoon, I'd like to focus on the commodification story I saw here, as it seems to surface so many of the tensions inherent in a lot of these other issues. In the 1991 novel, How to Make an American Quilt, you might also remember that was that perfectly horrible movie with Winona Ryder a couple of years later. But it was a book before then. And author Whitney Otto in that book writes about a group of women friends jointly working on a quilt. As they sew and share their lives, one of the characters laments, anyone who could buy something like a quilt is unabashedly immoral. There's clearly something personal about quilts. Quilts are narrative. Quilts are family heirlooms. I'm sure we all have quilt stories. My own great-grandmother's quilt was transferred through three generations, wrapped meticulously each time and stored in a closet, and I have it in my closet there. And I don't think it's been used since my great-grandmother used it. And I'll probably pass it on wrapped up to my kids. Quilts, you know, they're not babies and sex or bodies or body parts and the other traditional objects of the commodification literature, but in some ways, quilts are the anti-commodity. Throughout those many generations, the quilters of Gee's Bend probably never intended that their creations would reach the marketplace. They represent home, family, community values, anything but market values. So what does commodification theory tell us about this story? Using Peggy Radin's classic analysis in her 1987 work, Market Inalienability, these quilts are clearly, to some extent, bound up in personhood. The personhood of the women of Gee's Bend, their lives, their family, their struggles, ultimately their stories, like the quilter and How to Make an American Quilt, putting all of this into the marketplace in some ways just doesn't seem right. Through a value-based lens, traditional commodification theory asks, what do we want in the market and what do we want to keep out of the market? But as we discussed this morning, the false dichotomies in commodification theory, like the theories this morning, have slowly been exposed. The theory is taking a new look at markets. In Joan Williams and Martha Ertman's recent essay collection, Rethinking Commodification, they trace this evolution. Building on Radin's classic critique, some still argue that sex, babies, bodies, and body parts should be out of the market. Women and minorities get hurt in these transactions generally. Their personhood is threatened because their personhood usually is the commodity. But on the other hand, they are so often forced into such desperate exchanges. This is Radin's double bind. It echoes classic feminist legal theory literature around issues of victimhood and agency. Carrie's touched on this morning a little bit. And bell hooks and Tricia Rose, among others, also worry that cultural and ethnic identities and traditions are taken for the pleasure and financial benefit of the dominating culture. And they point to jazz, rhythm and blues, hip-hops as examples of this. But the new theorists are rethinking the power of the market and the benefits of commodification. They write endorsing its benefits for objects such as sex, Martha Nussbaum and Ann Lucas, reproductive ingredients like eggs and sperm, Martha Ertman, caregiving, Deborah Stone, housework, Catherine Silba, and even the holiday Kwanzaa as it's commodified by the African-American community itself, Regina Alston. These theorists have come to the conclusion that markets, so seemingly inappropriate for some things, are actually good for those very same things. In intellectual property, too, we weigh the advantages and disadvantages of increasing propertization and commodification of everything, especially traditional knowledge, products, indigenous identities. Susan and Boatema and Dan and my colleagues Peter Yazzie and Christine Farley have written about this. Does commodification of these things have the power to create cultural understanding and cultural evolution, or does commodification homogenize everything it touches, and in the process, remove all local meaning and context? Will this super commodification of the quilts of Guy's Bend through the Tinwood IP licensing juggernaut ultimately increase creativity in Guy's Bend or ultimately destroy it? I think Rebecca's question this morning made it clear that love created these quilts, and they're definitely invisible works that we were talking about this morning. And in this story I've told you, the incentives came and went, but the work stayed invisible. It stayed in those cabins. But does the commodification of the quilts and designs through the IP regime come at too great a cost for these women? Are they unwittingly alienating their identity, their culture, their heritage, and their tradition? Are the licensing ventures, the pet-proof rugs, the soy candles, these debit cards, mass-market bedspreads, stripping away all the personhood meaning and context bound up in the quilts and their designs? Salman Rushdie observed, those who do not have power over the story that dominates their lives, power to retell it, rethink it, deconstruct it, joke about it, and change it as times change, truly are powerless. Our culture, our story out there in the world is surely our power. The story of the women of Guy's Bend is out there in the world now, on both on museum walls and on mass market bedspreads in middle class homes. Are these women willingly sharing their tradition and culture? And through this sharing, are they empowered? The exposure has brought them worldwide acclaim, mass recognition, and respect. It's given them their own self-respect and allowed them to pursue what they love, their textile expression, with security and freedom. It's also arguably even revived a dying craft in the region, as there was evidence that a lot of the younger Guy's Bend women were leaving for the bigger cities of Mobile and Birmingham. Will it better their lives? The deals have already brought increased community resources, promised increased development, and may even soon deliver them a new community center. The question surfaced in the story of the quilts of Guy's Bend raises many of these classic tensions and conflicts. Which is worse for them, commodification or non-commodification? Is the Tinwood arrangement and all it offers the community maybe second best? Raiden herself used this economic theory to argue for incomplete commodification in some situations, even though imperfect, commodification is sometimes desirable if we undertake it. It happens with certain restrictions. The women of Guy's Bend have clearly ceded control, maybe too much control over their story, but what is the alternative? In these respects, this in or out, whether or not to commodify, is increasingly seen by these theorists as the wrong question. Instead, they asked, how do we want to structure the identity, or structure the quality of social relationships that involve elements of both economics and identity? In the intellectual property area, identity, knowledge, culture, and ideas are our commodities. Madhvi Sundar writes that we should not fear the rise in new intellectual property rights. We should focus instead on the social relationships at stake and the changing and substantive needs and desires of individuals and communities. Karis talked about the value of employing the similar theories of relational feminism and dialogue to intellectual property. Do aspects of the Tinwood arrangement with the Guy's Bend quilters based on these notions of moral rights and the droit de suite demonstrate some aspects of a more nuanced approach based on these theories? The arrangement with Tinwood focuses at least to some degree on an ongoing dialogue and listening to the needs and desires of the community of quilters. It also grants them an increasing degree of agency, some control over decisions and revenues, especially with regard to the quilts in which they retain the rights. It's my hope that the story of the women of Guy's Bend can somehow shed some light on alternative ways to fashion our IP laws by focusing more on the structure of these social relationships with disenfranchised creative communities. Thanks.
Thank you, and I'll take any questions you have in the discussion.
Like I said at the beginning, in these three papers, we see some of the themes we began with this morning be given very particular form in these three lovely stories that we've heard. Very briefly, what I want to do is look some at this the original dichotomy that Dan highlighted for us of mind-body or idea and instantiation, conception instantiation, and then the one that Carrie's gave us more of the original and the copy and how those play out in these particular stories. And what I'd like to do is think about some distinctions really from Marxist feminist theory that I think can help us think these through, because what we're looking at is the process of production, of creation. And to try to differentiate some between, I think, three important concepts. One is objectification. That very process in the creation that you that your idea becomes a thing, becomes real, is instantiated. The second is the process of alienation. Is that and what one of the things that feminists say here is that objectification and alienation don't necessarily go together, that is a creation of the historical conditions in which that objectification occurs, that creation, that instantiation. And then the third part is the commodification, and I think these three papers all look at those three concepts and bring us some insight from the intersectionality of class and of gender and of race. So for Vicky's paper, we saw the women of G's Bend getting much from the process of objectification before there was any alienation of it, before there was any commodification of it, but that alienation is not, it is a problematic and contradictory enterprise, that it involves that when the copyright was taken from them, paid for, not taken in the worst sense, but taken from them, there was obviously some alienation, that their personhood in their creations, at least for the ones before 1940, was no longer there. So it was the objects were partly theirs and partly not theirs anymore, if it occurred. And I guess that's sort of unclear from Vicky's paper whether or not that actually happened. But through that appropriation, various things that benefited them substantially that they wanted that were a part of the process of objectification occurred. And the commodification became an essential part of it. That first is art. These designs, these objects gained social status and social meaning by being labeled as art and being shown as art and becoming something socially different than they were in their creation, that perhaps took something from the women but also gave something to the women, took something from the community and perhaps gave something to the community. And then I think we can ask the same questions about the next level of commodification of the marketing of it and the branding of it. And to what extent did the women lose something in that process? Does that quilt on the bed in the ad look like the quilts in the museum? Is it the same for them? And to what extent is the getting of a community center and the getting of a road and the being the product of an academic conference here, having the recognition that comes with that, how does that all connect back to the original process of objectification? In Bottomer's presentation, we see some of these same issues playing out, and we see playing out and very interestingly in what she's done in two parallel, or not parallel, coexisting spheres, that the cloth, the creation of the cloth, the objectification of the men's labor in the designs here, was part of a social system in which they gained something. They, as Bradama points out, they when she went to talk to them, they weren't victims, that they were a part of a social system that had status and prestige and social meaning to it. And that they're sort of interesting in the copyright law, that it had, again, it has a complicated contradictory meaning in that the state becomes the owner of it, and the state, to what extent does that deprive them of meaning, and to what as craftsmen, and to what extent does that give them some meaning as the true owners of the historical craft heritage of the nation. But to what extent is that alienation, that they have very little, that they lose their subjectivity, that the state becomes a force over them? And then in this, in the parallel realm, in the realm that the women are operating in, we see a kind of reverse process, that it begins with commodification, that their status as traders, they are working in commodities, so they're beginning from the process of commodification, and they're kind of working backwards with these designs. They are then registering them, and they're appropriating them in a way, but they're also gaining access to them. They are claiming them. They are getting meaning other than through the commodification. They are gaining their own forms of social power, giving them to other women to trade in the market, creating a whole social sphere. And then going back to the beginning, to Susan's paper, we see the tension between creativity and copying. As with Bradama, we have this sphere of production where there's very little IP protection, but there are other mechanisms of social power, other social relations, other social dynamics that are happening there within the industry, and that there's a social function to the copying, that even though people don't have IP protection, they are nonetheless gaining much in the culture from the copying that, that occurs, and perhaps much of that could be said about that in the situation that Bradama describes too, that the copying is a taking of something, but it's also the spreading of the cultural heritage through the country, and that the men who are doing this cultural production don't seem particularly invested in the getting of being the legal subjects there, at least at this moment in history, and perhaps as historians this will all change. So I will leave this, my remarks, with the notion of contradiction, and that we can't live without the notion of contradiction, and that to say that any of these stories is necessarily good or necessarily bad is perhaps not the point of this exercise, that it is to point out that these different forces, when ideas are instantiated in things, are given meaning in things for people, for communities, for our larger society, contain within them certain contradictions that we have some ability to control and to affect. And this, I'd like to end with Vicky's point about it's the structure of the social relations and the political relations that we construct around these processes, not these processes in and of themselves, that is necessarily good or bad, and that it's our task in thinking about gender and IP to continue to think hard about these issues of what abilities do we have in revealing what the social relationships are to then create them and structure them in ways that foster a set of values that that we've talked about today, and I won't talk about now so that you can all talk some. So questions or thoughts about these wonderful stories?
Thank you. I just want to begin by thanking all the panelists for a fascinating set of talks. Really, thank you for that. And I think, Anne, that you've actually raised and considered all the questions, and I hope I'm not just reiterating it, but it's something that I always struggle with when we start talking about any form of expression or authorship that has been excluded from the intellectual property realm, as though the solution is then to include it in the intellectual property realm. And so, for me, I think feminists have learned over time that it's rarely the best route towards equality to make the arguments about the ways in which women are the same as men, or, you know, to align ourselves with that so then we can merit the same value, the same recognition, because essentially that's trying to squeeze ourselves into the same or the existing value structures which have historically been the source of the exclusion. And so I suppose the question becomes for me, can we even talk about and critique the exclusion of particular kinds of feminized cultural productivity without falling into this trap where the struggle for empowerment or the struggle for right becomes a quest for ownership and then the basis for subsequent alienation or commodification? There's an answer,
no,
by the way.
There's not a good answer, but there are many answers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I struggled with that in my story and in following the story of these women in trying to figure out what I thought about it all. And I think when Anne said that it wasn't my goal to try to decide whether this was good or bad or this or and the facts in my situation are so vague in terms of all I know about the structure of this deal is from this enterprise. So I would love to know the concrete facts about what went on. So it's unclear in my situation which of these things are in property and which are not. I mean, I like to think when I look at these things, there's a sufficient degree of originality and there is individual authorship, at least from what I understand. But in terms of deciding what is best, I mean, I really fell back on that structuring the relationship so that everybody's needs and desires are accommodated and listened to.
I have to say that when Anne sort of concluded on the sense of with the word contradiction, I had this great sense of relief because when I speak about this subject, the first question that lawyers at least always ask me is, so are you high protectionist or low protectionist? What should we do? And I keep saying, no, can we please move away from what I've referred to in the past as the tyranny of the prescriptive? It is possible to do scholarship that says, look, if we look at this realm, we have to acknowledge that we're not just being rational economic actors. We have very embedded cultural values. If we look at this as cultural studies people, as historians, as communications experts, and so forth, we have to be able to map this realm before we can start with our prescriptions. So I think that's extraordinarily important, and this is a beautiful space in which to be able to do that. You know, in my own realm, I know that you're struggling with it in your issue, and I love that you use bed quilts, and I'm so interested to hear more of this history. But legislation is moving forward, and so I may be forced to have to think about it in more concrete ways. And I really wanted the paper done before that happened. It moved too fast for me. But I do think that there's an enormous value to saying, you know, we can think about this not in terms of protect or don't, high or low, but in terms of difference. And I really appreciate that from both of you.
I'd like to respond as well. I think it's a question that is inevitable and it's not going to go away anytime soon. The way I like to think about it is, well, what is actually happening in the concrete world, to the extent that we agree that it is a concrete world? We have forces of globalization, globalization in very particular ways and in ways that are very, I think, unjust. The globalization of neoliberalism and market policies and the response of countries like Ghana, which you can see as a very pragmatic move. You know, and it's with respect to every lawyer in this room, it's a lawyer's solution. When you talk to people at the Copyright Office about why they don't conceive of it in broader ways, why they force it into this category, why they don't allow for individual, because folk knowledge is not always communal. Sometimes it is individual in origin. Why they don't make space for that? The arguments are about essentially administrative and legal expediency. And so at the level of the Ghanaian state and its responses, you find a certain combination of pragmatism, what do we do in a global market under these conditions, and, you know, bureaucracy, which is why the law gets challenged, continues to be challenged by scholars, by musicians, because they're the biggest voice, who they're not really out for the producers of material culture, but they do make this an issue. So I see it as a question that is going to have to be answered in a certain realm and debated in a certain realm with the hope that essentially these two converge. I mean, the likelihood that they will, I'm not very optimistic. But I think it is important to raise the question, you know, who cares about copyright when there are all these very rich ideas about alienability, within the principle of custodianship and equal distribution and distributive justice be a much better way? And isn't there a way of conceiving of having access to the cultural goods of the world, whether they are software or kente designs, in a way that that truly marks us as living in an era of civilization, you know, where we are civil in our relationships with each other, not just individually, but between regions and nations. I think those questions need to be raised, but I think that the struggle is going to go on at different levels. And so at the level of countries like Ghana, you're going to find these very pragmatic and frankly short-sighted solution. Interesting, because they're so problematic. You know, they give me a lot to work on, but very troubling. But I also think that it may not be entirely a negative thing for us to work within these frameworks. I think of Australian Aboriginal peoples who've been able to harness copyright to their ends. Why not appropriate these frames? If they lead to certain benefits. I don't think that should be ruled out entirely, but certainly it's not a question that I or any one of us can answer totally today. I do think it's a great one to keep in mind. Thanks.
Other questions?
I have a question. I do have a question for the two of you.
Particularly on the administratability of those distributive concepts, clearly there has not been as much development of equitable principles and equity law as there could have been. But you still have the ability to bring suits for unjust enrichment and other forms of redistribution that relate to the misappropriation or failures to share. And I'm just curious if you've seen at the level of Ghanaian law efforts to use the individualized legal action as the mechanism rather than a general legal principle as the way of accomplishing that.
You mean on the part of people who might be concerned about these particular forms of cultural production? Not that I know of. I think for the most part, it has tended to happen within the sphere of intellectual property. law. One of the most interesting people I spoke to was someone who you could think of as an innovator in Adinkra. He's using screen printing, but the cloth that he produces, he combines screen printing, which is kind of intermediate mechanized, with hand-woven cloth, but insists that he is working in the traditional sphere because that's where he started, and his cloth has been endorsed by royalty, by the indigenous system. And so he's a traditional craftsman, but because of his sense of himself as an innovator, he has tried in the past to protect his designs by using industrial property law. That he was unique in that respect, in conceiving of himself in that way. But what did he do about it? He went to intellectual property law. It's not very common as far as I'm aware. It might be in other spheres of cultural production that I'm not aware of. Yeah.
Hello. I have a question. I suppose after hearing Wadima's talk, especially, I have a question about the cause and effect. Because are there a lack of intellectual property rights because they are female-dominated industries, or does the lack of intellectual property rights keep the more economically driven male psyche out, I guess?
And that would be with regard to the mechanized?
I suppose with regard to the tech, I mean, this is a question for everybody because this is, because I had definitely was thinking it's a cause-driven distinction at first because there are no economic rights in the first two talks because it was an industry that is dominated by women. But then after your talk, I thought, well, maybe it's more of an effect in that the lack of economic property or intellectual property rights are keeping men out of this industry, at least in the United States.
I guess we have to answer it industry by industry or case by case. I think that in the case of the clothing and textile industry, or more specifically the clothing or the fashion industry, it's not that men have been kept out. It's that they've entered and then attempted to move the industry into a realm of intellectual property rights, and that's happened repeatedly decade after decade, and I only give you some of the examples. So I think it's a sense of the former. That is to say, it is gendered, it is low status in other ways, it is close to the body rather than close to the mind, it is a craft rather than an art, it is many of these things that have traditionally existed outside the IP realm, and so all of those things together have left it outside that scope of protection, and it's not that men haven't tried or haven't tried to enter. I think it's a result of those associations.
And I think all those things obviously hold true for quilting, and probably additionally quilting is even though these women have fairly unique designs, quilting is often collectively done, so their authorship issues and originality issues because it's so often sharing of patterns and done like that. But I think it's really outside because of the craft nature of it.
I mean, just briefly, a sense of the little propaganda film that the Council of Fashion Designers of America prepared for Congress had a whole bunch of young female designers of color, so forth and so on, and then a whole bunch of male executives who were speaking to the issue. So it was very, very, you know, the CEO of Hermès, for example, speaking to the issue. So it's definitely there.
That's similarly with the women of Gisbet. Their two agents were these white males who came into their lives and created this change for them.
I wondered in relation to the women how to understand what they're doing. Are they masculinized because they are operating effectively as legal subjects in a sphere that we think of as, that we often conceptualize as male, or do they feminize the sphere? And I prefer to think, you know, I'm kind of like go women. So I'm like, I prefer to think that they feminize a male sphere. But they do it because of their class. And so then it's hard for me to separate out, you know, what's operating here really. Is it gender? Is it class? And I don't think I can think of it. I think there I can't separate out the two. And it seems that class trumps gender, essentially, in that sphere. But I'll have to think about it a bit more. I'm not sure that I've, as yet, figured it out totally.
Well, on that note of our not having figured it out yet, I want to thank everybody for coming.
I had a quick question for my fellow panelists.
Go ahead.
Because it derives from something that you said in your remarks, and that is the difference between the original and the copy, and this question of the authentic. And it goes back to Dan this morning talking about maps, and I kept thinking of Baudrillard and simulacrum simulations, and the idea of a map that is created as an empire, and the empire itself disintegrates, but you're left okay. So in the case of both of these things, you have, sorry, it's too late in the afternoon for French theory. In the case of both of these things, you have copies that are valued in some ways and are certainly economically more valuable than the originals. And yet, you have this totemic value in the originals, the quilts that have been touched by the hands of the quilters of Giza G's Bend. And you have, in the case of the artisanal fabrics, there's a different valuation to them. And I wondered, given that the commercial realm seems to value the copies as much or more, or at least their quantities make them valued as much or more, what are we doing in terms of constructing those communities and potentially reifying those communities around their products? And how does that interaction work back and forth? And I just wondered if, because it pertains to both of you in the conversation, if you would maybe think about that for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. These quilts, the originals, the older ones, are $25,000-$30,000. I mean, they are hugely, hugely valuable now. Obviously, that doesn't measure up to Kathy Ireland's worldwide sale of bedspreads. That's God knows what that is. But I guess it goes back to what Anne said about that, the sort of hanging on the art walls, the status that gives them, and the importance, the empowerment that brings them. And I guess ultimately that status enables the mass marketing, the copies. Mm-hmm. And there has been copying. I went into a rug store down on 14th Street and was told that they have these wonderful rugs that are patterned after, you know, African-American quilting traditions. And I looked at these rugs and I said, what quilting traditions are you talking about? And he hauled out one of these Tinwood books. And I looked at the rug manufacturer and it wasn't one of these multitude of licensed products. So it's, you know, it's going on. And these were really expensive rugs. These weren't Kathy Ireland items. These were New York high-end hand-woven rugs. So it's out there, and it's, I don't know, you know, it's an interesting question. I do need to explore more for sure.
Mm-hmm. In the case of Edinkra and Kente cloth, I guess if you were talking in terms of the larger Ghanaian economy, which generates more money, perhaps you could say that the imitations are more economically valuable, but I'm not sure. There's kind of a hierarchy of value, at least in Ghana, not so much, say, in the African-American market, where the imitations are very popular. But you will have people who will insist on the handmade cloth. You know, say they're getting married, and either a woman wants to wear it for her marriage, or the man she's going to marry gives it as part of the bride wealth. There really is no substitute for that. You cannot use the mechanized version. For women, for Ghanaians, but generally, especially for women, cloth, there's a whole culture of cloth that I could talk about and I'll go into, but it becomes a way of storing and transferring wealth. And as far as that goes, there is no substitute for these. So there's this ranking in which, and this is why I say the craftsmen are not victims, because they work the differences. You know, they'll sell the old antiques that their grandfather made to, this is their term, the white folks, you know, because of the value ascribed to so-called authenticity and antiques. And then they'll do commissioned pieces for, say, the Asante King or for a discriminating customer. And they'll do their version of run-of-the-mill. It still takes 3 months to produce, but, you know, it's nothing special. And then they'll do the tourist versions. And they'll work, they know, and in their shops you will find products made from the roller-printed imitations, you know, and those go to the tourists who couldn't care less. They just want a bit of Africa to take back home. Mm. And so you have these things going on. I'm sorry, I keep looking at the wrong people. You asked the question. You have this ranking of value where you slip from one into the other, and you can't really say that one has superseded the other very clearly.
Thank you. Thanks, Anne.
Well, with that further clarification on our not knowing exactly where we are, we will end. And to thank you all for being a part of this project of mapping intellectual property concepts and gender theory onto each other. I don't think it's a mapping of one onto the other, but it's a mapping that goes both ways. I hope to see you all next year at our next one, and I understand that people are doing other places, so I hope that this project of ours, as well as generating the wonderful work that you are all doing, is generating a broad community in which people feel comfortable doing this kind of work and excited about it, and we can see it, even if it becomes alienated, if not commodified, seeing this work reflected in different forms in the world. And thank you all for being here for today and making it so great. Thank you.